Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 132 of the podcast. If you're new to the show, I want to welcome you. Highway to Health is your place for trusted health guidance and support. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve our state of being and experience together on the planet. So I started this podcast as a way to explore ways to well-being and improve the dialogue about a more integrative approach to care, which means looking at ways to improve the long-term well-being of people in our communities. And I really believe at the end of the day, it's our communities that inspire us and keep us well. I met Jen Gilhoy, my guest for today's show, back in March at a sauna event here in Minneapolis. It's rare to have social events that are geared towards wellness and don't involve alcohol, but it's something I've been seeking out more, and it's exactly what Jen is targeting with Zero Proof Collective. Her recent TED Talk, Why We Should Rethink Drinking Culture, released just a couple weeks ago, has already gotten 35,000 views as I record this. And it asks us to consider our relationship with alcohol, not in a shaming way, but in a way that gives us permission to consider whether we want to change this relationship, and even perhaps demand alternatives that might lead to better relationships with others and ourselves. If you'd like to watch us have this conversation, you can always find it on Highway to Health channel on YouTube. Please enjoy my conversation with Jen Gilhoy. What is your background, you know, prior to kind of getting into work around NA culture?
Yeah, my background really starts in marketing. So 20 plus years in the Twin Cities area of marketing and communications and a lot of events. And what I noticed with events, I was with the American Institute of Architects for 10 years, and we hosted a lot of events and celebrations. And that was, at a point in my life where I was drinking, and it just was very central. And I've always noticed that. And then once I left corporate America, I kind of, I took this entrepreneurial path, and the events are still, the same. Anytime I would go anywhere, I would always have the experience of being welcomed with a drink in hand. You know, the first thing you do is go to a bar, check in, cash in your drink ticket. So yeah. It's just being surrounded by alcohol in literally every workspace has just been part of something I've really noticed. And actually my work right now is in that space to kind of bring awareness to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Since we had this conversation in the sauna with the group, I've been thinking a little bit more about it, and I've had quite a few things go on in the last few years with people around me and drinking. I had a friend who had oral cancer issue. My wife has had a lot of, probably has like a very adverse reaction to alcohol compared to most people. So that has kind of limited, or she's pretty much not drinking anymore. Like she'll have one once in a while. I think what I started going back through after we had our conversation was thinking about, my history of drinking and kind of where it started. I wasn't an early drinker. It was sort of banned in high school if you were going to play sports. Like they took it very seriously, and kids were getting kicked off of teams and stuff. So I didn't really start till I was in college, and I was always I was never like a blackout drinker, or I also felt like I had a pretty high tolerance, which can be dangerous. I know now that I know the science of this stuff. And then, I was a musician through most of my 20s. So I spent a lot of time, as you're saying, like drink tickets were basically payment, and just thinking about how alcohol has been used in my life for these different kinds of things. And then, I was kind of a poor musician for a good chunk of time. So I didn't have a lot of money to drink on, outside of going out, which was probably, a nice safety net that I didn't realize I had. But then I moved to New York, and I lived there for 13 years, and I've been going back to work there for 10 years. And so the culture, the functional, drinking culture there is very strong. Like it's part of pretty much everything that you do. And certainly every, I started thinking a lot about it, and we had this conversation a little bit about how it's tied to events, to, holidays, to meals, to just about anything you can think of, concerts and sporting events and all these things. And it seems unavoidable. And yet the options are just so poor. It's either sugary drinks or water.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So much there, Jeremy. I'm thinking I liked your term history of drinking, and that might be a good exercise for everyone to do, to go back and see how it evolved. I too was very involved in high school and sports. I kind of stayed away from it and really didn't get into drinking until I went to college. And on college campuses nowadays, there are things that are happening that are, there's still, the binge drinking is still continuing. And then as you go into corporate, the expectations or in the workplace are all still there. So going through a history of like what your drinking patterns have been, how you noticed when you use it and what, you know, what situations it's gotten you into, has it been good or bad? Like really questioning that might be an interesting exercise for reader or for listeners to go through.
Yeah. And since we had, you know, this, since I think you mentioned the Huberman podcast that came out last fall.
Yes.
So I had to go back and listen to it, and I think I may have listened to it. But just going back and listening to it, you know, in preparation for this conversation, I there's so much in there because basically he's kind of going through a number of things, trying to parse out. I mean, he's not a drinker. So, you know, that probably needs to be, you know, considered. But at the same time, he is a scientist and he's, you know, he's very, you know, into peer reviewed things. And so, you know, he's even asked listeners a lot of times to like, if you can refute any of this, like, please give me the information if there's different studies, which I appreciate about him. But a lot of what he was going through was trying to figure out, are these, you know, this old, not necessarily recommendation, but this thing that we felt was safe to do, or may even be beneficial to our health of drinking a drink a day or two drinks a day, and that maybe wine has something in it that's beneficial to our heart. It is not really the science. We're not finding the science to prove it. In fact, we're finding that even at that level, that's enough to start, you know, diminishing a lot of stuff that's going on vascularly in our system and in our brain. So it's
absolutely,
you know, it's definitely something that we should be made more aware of and should be educated about.
Yeah, that's a fantastic podcast. It was August of 2022, if you want to go back and check it out. And what, it was an hour and a half.
I'll put a link on the show notes here too.
Yeah. And I, for myself, I would categorize myself as a sober necessary person. Mm-hmm. I had blackout experiences. My propensity to become an alcoholic after listening to that podcast, I was like, yeah, I had all of the kind of warning things. And one of the biggest things that I noticed is I did have a high tolerance. And for me, things just got more fun the more that I drank. Yeah. And what is a natural mechanism in a lot of the population is that because alcohol is a depressant, you kind of taper off and you don't. I had the opposite effect on me. And the way he explains it in that podcast, I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, it just made so much sense. I've never heard anyone describe that feeling of why, when I'm having so much fun, I just don't have an off switch. Mm. So really great podcast to listen to. And really the science is the way that I am seeing it in the media now. And there's a couple New York Times articles and the Canadian study that just came out that actually said no amount of alcohol is safe. And I have never seen that in writing. I've never heard a study or anyone willing to commit to that statement. And so that to me seems like there's a shift in saying, you know, can I have two drinks? You know, what is the normal? Now it's based on this like continuum. So how many, you know, drinks do you have? You're at risk, even if you have two drinks a week. It's along a continuum versus being this cold, hard, like safe, not safe.
Right. And I kind of wonder, you know, if, I don't know if you were a smoker, but I was a mild smoker when I was younger because I was in bars all the time, and it was just like, I was, you know, playing music and I was bored half the time. But I wasn't like a full-on smoker, thankfully, but I kind of liken this movement that's going on right now. It feels very similar to what happened 20 years ago or whatever it was when the smoking ban happened in bars and restaurants. And even the reaction that I'm, you know, as I'm talking about this with different people, and you know, I'm not one to jump in and say like that I'm going to completely stop something, but I also feel like I'm becoming much more aware of just the presence of alcohol around me, and also the annoyances that come along with alcohol, and so that's kind of where I'm starting to feel like there is this shift going on. And is that something that you feel like you've you've been part of, because you've been kind of working around this space for what, 4 or 5 years? Is that about?
Yeah, right? At least. I have about 8.5 years of sobriety, yeah, and really dove into being vocal about my story and the social spaces piece of it 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
And what was the moment for you in terms of your decision that sobriety was necessary?
Oh yeah. So many things. And I think, trying to control it, I spent 2 decades just trying to control it because I wanted to avoid having to go into the only place that I knew that I would need to go, which would be an AA room, mm-hmm, and say the words, "Hi, I'm Jen. I'm an alcoholic." I was like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I distinctly understood as the hugest, gap in our ways to get well and figure out our drinking. It just was either that or, and many people aren't willing to take that step. And AA at the time, 10 years ago, when I started to get sober, was one of the only options that was free and available. And now, of course, there are many online ways, there's inspirational podcast. There's so many different ways right now to explore your relationship with drinking. And we don't even use the word alcoholic as often, you know, it's like, right, we don't want, right, to be defined. What other, you know, disease is defined as like, I am all of this, which I rejected for decades.
Yeah.
And then going through the program said the word only because I knew that it would be an avenue to figure out what I could take from the program and use, and then what didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And that has held a lot of people back. And really, I think that is the question in terms of like getting people to open up to exploring their relationship with alcohol. And it really can look very different now.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons people don't drink. You mentioned your wife. I find a ton of women my age are like, yeah, I was a normal drinker, but now because of aging or the physical effects of it, mm-hmm, I either can't, or the, you know, repercussions from like a couple glasses of wine don't even affect me to the kind of that buzz that they were looking for. And then they suffer through, yeah, poor sleep the next day, the productivity levels are down. So once you look at that and understand how it impacts, it's hard to make a case that you can safely or healthily drink, you know, for women, 10 drinks a week.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say productivity, because I think where a lot of drinking stems from is this like sense that we need to like push so hard all day long. Mm. And there isn't really an off switch to that except for alcohol. And we don't have a lot of other things that we're able to use. We know maybe exercise might be one of the things, mm-hmm, that we can replace, but I've also seen studies that say that people who are extreme exercisers also tend to be, yes, extreme drinkers, you know? So it sort of says something about what's going on in the brain, you know, that's triggering all these kinds of things. And it gets back to the sort of mental, emotional part of what drinking is really about.
Yeah. I love that we're going here, because the mantra, you know, work hard, play hard, always applied to me. And yeah, I've been an avid person, like working out has been such a core thing of my life. I've done that forever. And so when I started abusing alcohol, what I used to do is wake up, you know, the next morning hungover and be like, well, if I can get on that spin bike and work out for an hour, if I can go on a 6-mile run, I can reset my body. Like, yeah, the night before never happened. And you know, that somehow being, you know, younger, and that was my mindset to kind of prove to myself that I didn't have a problem. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, if I worked out at the end of the day, for example, I would go right into drinking. It was like, oh my God, I made it through the day, made it through my work day,
yep,
made it through my workout. Now I get this reward.
Right.
And that I think is so common for so many individuals. And it keeps you in the cycle of saying, I don't have a problem. I can show up at work. I can, you know, be with my kids. But for me, that all fell apart at age 40. Just all the pressures and the elevation of like how much I was drinking, it just was not sustainable.
Yeah. And that reward cycle that you're talking about, I think is a big part of, I mean, it's a big part of a lot of abuses. Have you read that that Russell Brand book, Freedom from Addiction, by any chance?
I know my husband has it. Yes.
So it's an interesting book. One of my clients recommended. He has had a number of addictions, and you know was telling me this is a really good book to understand, not just drug addictions, but the addictive nature of our culture. And I found it fascinating and funny because he's using the 10-step program as sort of like the structure for it, but then he changes the wording of the 10-step program so that it's like, mm-hmm. you know, so that it's funny basically. But he also goes very deep into like all the things that were his problems, and some of the things that he talks about were, you know, the hard drugs in some ways were easier to quit than mm-hmm. alcohol or food or sex or things that become, you know, they feel like very normal parts of our culture, and they're present in everything. Where hard drugs, you have to make, you know, you have to do some work mm-hmm. to get them. So that was I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing. But he really goes into like, you know, our addiction to technology and to status and to just all these different pieces that once mm-hmm. you look at it and you're present to like the social media culture and the way that we sort of are marketed to, you're like, oh my God, we're just, we're pawns in all these things.
Right. Well, and I want to get back to the comment you had earlier about cigarettes, smoking in the bans and like parallels to what we see with alcohol. And I think that is true. Both my partner in Zero Proof Collective, Kate Faulkner, and I have talked about that at length, and I've seen it come out in many places that this will be the norm at some point in the future, where alcohol use and abuse will be looked at as, you know, cigarettes were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the data is just starting to shift and people are, you know, understanding the science behind it. And it's one of those things in our culture that people hold so near and dear. You know, cigarette smoking could be something you would do in a group in a bar setting, but alcohol is just so more pervasive and so more accepted that people are literally holding on to it. I say in my TED talk, which we'll get to, but I was like, no, please don't take it away. I mean, it's how I celebrate, relax, right. unwind. It's been my go-to forever.
Right.
So that's hard. That's hard to uncouple from your daily life and really take an honest look at it.
Yeah. And it seems like that is kind of your mission though, is to figure out, you know, what this transitional piece is. Is that kind of what Zero Proof Collective is?
Yes. So we are at the intersection now. So what is this? March 2023 of having, you know, wanting to say in our social spaces that we want non-alcoholic options. Mm-hmm. Started saying that years and years ago, 5 years ago, I was like, why can't I get a decent non-alcoholic beverage in this place that's not a soda or a water?
Yeah.
Well, fast forward to now where we've had this convergence of the beverages and the makers being so interesting, you know, profile flavors, like an entire experience that's not trying to mimic what alcohol was, but right. rather be a completely separate experience that is so interesting that people are now, they used to ask me, you know, why aren't you drinking in a social setting? Now with an elevated non-alcoholic beverage, they're asking, what are you drinking? And then can I drink that? I'd like to try that. What is it? So the curiosity factor, like that is kind of where I feel like we're at in terms of like a tipping point in terms of now we actually have the tactical products to get into people's hands to make that transition in a social space, which social spaces are the downfall of so many people that have worked so hard on their recovery journey, me included. Relapses and returns to use happen because of the experiences we have in our social spaces.
Right. And it also kind of reminds me a little bit of this shift from, you know, meat eating as well, because
we've
also, you know, gone through some of this and just the kinds of options. And yet I find myself, I'm mostly pescatarian. So at this point I'm kind of not leaning as much on some of the faux meats as I am on like going back to like vegetables and lentils and stuff that has a little bit more substance that I'm just finding a lot more from that. And it seems like because I got to try one of your drinks at the sauna, I feel like I kind of got a sense of what that is, and there's so many new options between, you know, that could actually be like, you know, energy boosters and health promoters in the drinks, different kinds mm-hmm. of herbs and the nootropes Absolutely. And all these things that I think could be actually, you know, a game changer for a lot of people just in terms of how they feel.
Yeah, the public definitely needs an education on that. I mean, it used to just be like, you just accept whatever alcohol was in your beverage and drink it. Now, between all of the additives and all of the things that can affect your body, especially when you're mixing some of those things, it's important to understand, like, what is the dosage? Like, some of the products that we're trying now have all sorts of layers to them, but also, like, how does this affect me? So learning that. And also being in a safe environment to understand how it affects you and be able to make a choice, you know, that's not for me, or feel like you can have the experience you want to have when you're enjoying that beverage.
Yeah. So is that part of Zero Proof Collective? Are you trying to do some education? Are you bringing this in? And because I've been exploring them just as in supplemental form with like the adaptogens and mm-hmm. and, you know, different kind of botanics like the, what is it, rhodiola that mm-hmm. can be, that can have that sort of, you know, relaxation effect and, you know, and kombucha just as it almost tastes like an alcoholic beverage if it's served in a, right. the right glass. It's kind of, I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah. Education is definitely at the forefront. So Zero Proof Collective we founded it in May of last year, so 2022. And we bring industry leaders who care about the non-alcoholic beverage space together to talk about where do we need to collaborate? Where do we need to bring awareness to the non-alcoholic movement? And one of the first things, you know, that we've started doing is kind of tiering, like, what does a non-alcoholic offering look like in a restaurant? Because the biggest feedback we get is, oh, yeah, my favorite restaurant has a non-alcoholic menu. And then it's now we're probing, okay, what is actually on it? How much sugar are in these drinks? And is it an afterthought? And, the, you know, one of the biggest challenges in bars and restaurants is they make their money through alcohol sales.
Right.
And they hold that near and dear to their experience in their space, especially if it's more bar than restaurant. And, you know, trying to overcome barriers to talk with those restaurant owners to make sure they understand that actually an elevated in a cocktail, you can charge, you know, $12 to $14 and you can up-level people from a Diet Coke to this experience that, hey, it also really pairs well with your food. And those people are going to leave having an experience like no other, because right. those people right now are settling when they are told we don't have anything for you. It just happened to me the other night at a kind of more high-end restaurant in Minneapolis. And I was like, here we are. So that is one distinction that we want to educate on is, you know, restaurant owners can start with a base level of NA offerings, but the kind of ultimate is that a restaurant would have maybe 4 or 5 non-alcoholic cocktails, and they're going to have a couple non-alcoholic, maybe local brands and brews, and then maybe a red and white non-alcoholic wine. And the wine category has just exploded even end of last year. Like we've tasted red wines that we're had to question, are you sure this is no alcohol? Oh, wow. Because it's really come a long way.
And so by industry leaders, which industries are you meeting with the most right now?
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating because it's a lot of general managers, bartenders, people that, you know, engage with the public, because we also realize that we can't just put some NA options into these social spaces without some education or an explanation or delivering an experience that matches. So I would say bars, restaurants, those people that are in that industry will come to our meetings. And then we just have a cross section of different makers, like product makers locally who have one product and they're like, how do we, you know, make this just more available in our liquor stores and our bars and restaurants? And that's a whole nother conversation because our systems for distribution in the States aren't really set up to allow non-alcoholic products to just kind of come in under the massive orders of liquor that go to a restaurant.
Right.
We do have people that, like, for instance, have a vending company. And so we've been just talking, like, how do we just get more of the product and the vision into our social spaces? And that does include corporate as well, which has been a really interesting avenue to explore.
What's happening in corporate then that you've been engaged with? I'm curious about this.
Yeah, you know, the whole, you know, pandemic and revisions of mission statements and companies that say they place well-being at the forefront. This is an unlooked space. They provide mental health services. They provide vegan options at their events, but nobody is asking, what if we, you know, work to create a culture that decentralized alcohol? So not even taking it away, but just not placing it at the center of your corporate experience. And it is everywhere and it's so prevalent. And employers sometimes have this thing where if I take the alcohol away from like a employee celebratory event, they're not going to come. You know, it's like some of these realities, but there is a way to do it. There's a way to start creating that. And that's why I think corporate is so interesting, because, you know, your employees are there to be productive, and, you know, your job is to also keep them safe in these work environments, and you're plying them with alcohol and sending them home.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially a little bit of a disconnect.
My wife went back to school later and got her MBA. So she started in a corporate role in her 30s. So it was interesting because, and I'm almost 10 years older than her. So there was this big, you know, for me, there was a big gap of like seeing these, you know, mid 20 somethings coming into these jobs for the first time and, you know, not having, they're not being paid very well yet. So these events are huge and they basically just, you know, go crazy on the free alcohol. And I saw a lot of problems happening there. I saw a lot of problems happening between relationships that after alcohol was served, you know, at the beginning, a couple of drinks in, that's fine. You can have some good conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, you might open up a little bit more, but it was almost inevitable that the night would continue after the event. And so, yes. and that's where problems were happening. Even people getting arrested and it's like craziness.
Yeah, it goes to the extreme, doesn't it? I mean, that was my experience.
You've probably been around it too, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I think there is an opportunity in corporate to really define what could that look like and how, you know, in thinking about Gen Z and millennials coming into that equation and actually preferring companies that don't lead with alcohol.
What about I've been going to more sports events with my son. He's a huge sports fan, and so we've gone to a couple Timberwolves games and a game at Allianz, the soccer team, the other day. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the price of these drinks. And I back to your point of like, how do you replace? There has to be this replacement of a $17 or $19 drink at a sporting event. How can the stadiums make up for that loss? Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of revenue.
Yeah. Just in general, in the research we've done in the Twin Cities area, trying to get into different venues like, you know, Target Field and say, could we do work with you to provide more NA options? And usually it's based on, there's a resistance there for sure. And it's typically based on where they get their alcohol brought into the stadium and these massive contracts. So what we see in those locations for non-alcoholic options are like a Guinness Zero or a Bud Zero,
right.
You know, which is fine. But in my experience at one of the Twins games, the bartenders don't know where it's at. You know, you got to walk down two levels to one random bar. The work that you have to put in, I've even researched stuff prior to going to events to see, am I going to be able to like have an option? And there's no communication. So, and again, with my background in marketing communications, I am about that experience. So even if you only have a Bud Zero available, if it is available everywhere and it's served like with enthusiasm and like you ask about what are the NA options and the server says, oh yeah, we just got Bud Zero on tap or whatever. And they're excited about it. I'm good. There's a lot to be said about delivering an experience, even regardless of the products that are offered. And then I would say to the price point, the ready-to-drink category, where you can just, you know, pop open these amazing beverages, drink within its own container, not even have to be mixed. Those price points might come in at $5 to $7 per. And a lot of times we are sometimes mixing those with another, you know, soda water, whatever. And those are really affordable options. So it can be done. And there's obviously also non-alcoholic distilled spirits that you can swap out for whatever alcoholic drink you'd be creating.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how it works on the tax basis. But I would imagine that that is part of the extra, the cost of these, like, let's say at an event like this, a concert or a sporting event, that part of the reason for the increase is probably somewhat due to tax. And if you take that away, are you able to offer an NA drink that's like getting closer in terms of what kind of revenue a place could make? You know,
that's a great question. If anyone's listening that has a contact that's willing to have those conversations with us, we've just had many roadblocks into that. But I think that that's the reality. Like, if we can understand and solve for those challenges, that's just makes it an easier way to get in.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what you're mixing up. I'm curious to know what I was drinking the other day in terms of like, in terms of like, what kinds of things are you thinking about in terms of, you know, what people find, you know, attractive in terms of the flavors, what you can actually infuse into it that does have some health benefits?
Yeah, for sure. So as mentioned, my partner in Zero Proof Collective, Kate, has an amazing background and understands the science and the flavor palette. So what we have found as a huge success is we worked with a local restaurant here who is really focused on quality of food. And we worked directly with the executive chef. So as we were creating what those non-alcoholic beverages would be on their permanent NA menu, there were things like tea infusions. And one of the biggest challenges was creating what we call like the viscosity of a drink. So a lot of times non-alcoholic beverages can feel watered down.
Right.
And you maybe don't get like the warmth when you drink it. But when you start looking at how you can actually make those sort of, you know, experiential things happen from a flavor perspective, from a texture, that makes it interesting. So, you know, we currently at Zero Proof Collective don't have a product, but we are working with all the members of our community to put their product forward. For example, there's a tea person that we have in our community that was a great fit for this restaurant. So all of his teas are part of the base of the non-alcoholic beverages on the menu. It's just like a beautiful thing. So it's like we're pulling together local resources, providing a really quality menu. And then, hey, by the way, we're also driving our audience who cares about these experiences. We're going to drive them to your restaurant and bar. We're going to tell them that you're going to deliver an amazing experience. And we've trained staff. They understand that they can up-level someone from a Diet Coke into this, you know, elevated cocktail. Feels great for them. They get the revenue. And we all actually are getting the data from that restaurant modeling. I mean, we really launched that menu early January. So we have 3 months of data showing how they've been able to transition some of that, you know, $3 NA into something that's more profitable.
Right. And I imagine aesthetic is also another aspect of this, right? I
mean, yes.
The stemware, the things that you put into the glasses. I have some good friends from Belgium. And so every beer has a different, you know, shaped glass because it has to do with the temperature they want to keep it at and all those kinds of things. But it also just like there's a feel to it. Sometimes for whatever reason, the way it fits in your hand feels like the right kind of beverage for you. So I'm sure that's another piece of it.
Well, take the sauna experience. I mean, you're really looking for something refreshing. And so like citrus is part of what I bring to sauna experiences just because you're looking for something, you know, in that space. And we, you know, change out our drinks seasonally. The things that we experiment with pair really well with what we're suggesting. Mm. So it's been really fun to experiment and then also be in spaces where alcohol is typically offered and then, you know, put this option in front of them and see and have the conversation with people in terms of what it is. Because if we can't describe what we want in a beverage, it's really hard to ask a server to provide that or tell your favorite restaurant, here's actually what I'd like to see.
Yeah. So getting on to your TED Talk that's coming out, we were hoping it was going to drop before today.
Yes, I'm hopeful.
But
soon.
But I think, you know, because I'm present to a lot of, because I work in an integrative health field and I'm present to a lot of different kinds of health challenges, alcohol tends to come up a lot. And there's a real spectrum of alcohol disorders, you know, as we might say. And you know, for some people, it doesn't seem to have a huge effect on them until they're basically presented with you know, another, you know, problem or a co-infection that's somehow throwing off their physiological balance. And then it becomes clear that alcohol is working against their ability to recover. So, I imagine this is going to be something that you're kind of bringing up in this talk a little bit is, you know, where to start in terms of addressing, you know, what kind of issues you may have, or, you know, what your relationship with alcohol is. Is that kind of what this is about?
Yeah. So the talk is titled Sober, Not Somber, and then Lightning Way to Evolve Drinking Culture. So there are many TED Talks on a person's like personal relationship with alcohol. And so with my talk, I really tried to focus on the social experience and what we can do to understand what's happening there. So the talk does get into, you know, alcohol is the underlying cause of all these things, from domestic violence to, you know, bad choices, getting in a car and driving. Like, we just haven't looked at it, or we haven't named it. Mm-hmm. And there was an article in the Star Tribune locally here in January that was estimating the cost to the state for everything that is the cause of it is underlying is alcohol misuse. And so we're starting to like see more of what those conversations are. And my talk is just very clear about this is what's happening. Like, we want to look at every other thing that could possibly cause it. But at the root of so many of our problems and challenges, that's what we find. Alcohol is there and it's present. And so my wish for people is to not try to define the question, am I an alcoholic or not? Is to say, how would my life be improved if I drank a little bit less? Like, really just making it as accessible as possible for everyone. And I feel like maybe in early sobriety, I had a lot of anger toward people who could drink and control it somehow.
Right.
And now, you know, with so many years of sobriety, I do feel like I'm the luckiest, because it's just not a decision for me. I just don't have to make that decision. Alcohol does not work for me. I will not be drinking it. But for those that are, you know, experimenting with it, it can be very hard if you're going into it to answer that question.
Yeah. No, I think that's an amazing way to look at it. I do the same kind of thing with a lot of different things when I'm working with people who are struggling to. Usually there's a healing process going on, whether it's recovering from COVID, which I've been doing a lot of work with, to different kinds of, you know, physical orthopedic injuries. There's one thing that I think tends to work for most people, which is to start thinking about making a 10 or 15% change. Like, I actually think that we do really well within that kind of shift. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, taking something away from somebody, whether it's alcohol or sugar or pasta or whatever it is,
it doesn't work long term.
It's not going to work. And even sometimes just, you know, adding something that percentage. I work with a lot of people who are sleep challenged, and that's a huge piece of healing. A lot of times is to get that necessary amount of sleep. And so for people who have been in bad sleep patterns, you know, getting that 10 or 15% shift to happen. And I try to work within, you know, short time periods. I really want to see someone go through a shift within that first month that I'm working with them. So I usually suggest a few different things like this to get them on track. And alcohol is one of the things that I usually, you know, suggest starting to scale back. And in a situation where things are dire, I might say, like, you know, half of what you've been doing this month, because I just feel like we know what an impact that has. And some, you know, it can be other types of things too, that I find. And sometimes it's a sugar issue, and sometimes it's a Diet Coke issue. I mean, you would not believe
some
of the issues that people have with things like Diet Coke. So anyway, it just feels like a I like the way your phrasing is with this, to not have it, you know, be shaming, and to not feel like you have to have a diagnosis or a definition for yourself to start out with, just to start kind of reimagining, you know, yourself differently, or reimagining your cultural experience differently.
Yeah. And I noticed, you know, Dry January this year celebrated 10 years, and that started in the UK with the idea, you know, the idea behind it was to really improve social behavior, and it's continued. But you know, there's good and bad to that, because it does give people 30 days to try it without. But many people are like, February 1, I am back at it. And so I always think it's so wonderful to be able to give that experience and have that knowing, because it does, you do come back to that at some point in your life. You might be like, yeah, I remember that month. I felt pretty awesome. Like for myself, when I was pregnant with both of my children, wasn't drinking. And I was so happy. I was just like, it's the happiest times of my life. Like other women would complain about being pregnant. Later, you know, when I actually stopped drinking, I was like, wow, I didn't even realize how, like, the correlation between not drinking and, you know, just having that time in my life where it wasn't an option was so freeing. It was absolutely freeing. So, like, I don't know. I say that to just be like, I hope people do notice if they are doing some challenges like that and omitting it, like journaling about it, writing about it to really understand it.
Yeah. And it's, I always think it's interesting. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I would say my alcohol use actually increased as I became a parent, you know, it's a serious thing to consider, I think, because, you know,
I mean, you've been there.
So there is this period of time where you don't, especially when your kids are small, you don't get any sort of breaks until you finally get someone to bed. And it's like a lot of times it's the first thing that you do. I mean, my wife and I would just sit down and have a glass of wine or something. That was like a very common thing to do. And then a lot of times we'd finish that bottle of wine.
Right? Yes.
I mean, and that becomes sort of like the pattern though. And that's where it starts to get dangerous is you need to have some other way of enjoying your time together. And a lot of times it is the ritual of sitting down together and doing something like this and having that. So,
yeah, absolutely. I love that you use the word ritual. I think that's a lot about what we talk about. And I have found that I have, like, after a sauna experience, I will come home and have an amazing non-alcoholic cocktail. And I have one, and it's part of my ritual. And it has served me in the way that I thought alcohol used to. So replacing that and pairing and thinking about that. And then I just also wanted to quickly comment on the glamorization of alcohol. So one of the things in my talk that I point out is mommy wine culture, or, you know, all these ads, same with cigarettes, right? We used to see the glamorization of that on all of our magazines. That was banned. Yeah. And I think that all matters. And I think, and I hope we will start seeing less of that on social media. I mean, I've seen some pretty, like, I'm like, I don't want to follow this person on Instagram because I don't want to see the glamorization of it. I don't want that in front of me. I don't want other women in particular with young children to think that that's their go-to.
Yeah.
So I think if we can shift that, that will be a huge help and a deterrent and give people other ways to equally celebrate and enjoy their lives, right?
Yeah. So outside of the kind of cultural pieces of what you're working on, is there a product development going on? Is that something you want to get into?
You know, potentially with Kate with Zero Proof, there may be something. One of the biggest things, like I mentioned earlier, that we're creating is a playbook for NA event offerings. So again, just staying really in the education space because there's so much work to do. And our product might be, for example, hosting a non-alcoholic bar at a very large corporate event and talking with, you know, the company as they roll out what the event is and in really highlighting that, like for a continuum of an employee experience to understand why it's being offered and, you know, what the benefits could be. Because we know that like a third of our population in America, at least, actually prefers not to drink. But a lot of times they aren't voicing that. They don't feel comfortable in those spaces to say actually that what they're doing is settling for a club soda with lime or water.
Totally,
it's just painful. Yeah, it's just painful.
Well, I'm going to give a shout out here to Erin Flavin and Marigold. She happens to be somebody I've known since she was a teenager. We share a shared friend. And her brother is one of my longtime closest friends. And so, we've been talking a little bit. We went on a hike together last weekend. And we're talking about what I think would be really nice to have in Minneapolis is to have some event spaces. And it's starting to happen a little bit more with the THC cannabis culture that's, you know, mm-hmm. been freed up to serve in any place in Minneapolis just about. But I don't necessarily think it has to be that. I think a lot of times people would choose a non-alcoholic option by itself. If there was like a really cool group of people, it could be for music, it could be for any kind of event or corporate gathering or whatever. I think there needs to be some spaces. So anybody listening who really wants to push into that, I think there's a huge opportunity here right now in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And in New York too, because I'm there pretty regularly, and I haven't seen, to be frank, I haven't seen as much non-alcoholic option in bars and restaurants there as I have here.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say all of that, because Sauna, for example, is an experience that is centralized on community and conversation, and mm-hmm. almost like the sidebar. And why I love it is that people aren't pushing alcohol on me when I come in the sauna. You know, it's just like not even asked.
Yeah.
So what, you know, and people also aren't going to bars and restaurants and they're going to sit on a bar stool and have, you know, 8 non-alcoholic beverages. So recognizing that bringing NA into our culture is going to revolve around other activities that are paired really well with people who choose not to drink. And that's the way I see it. That's why you know, Marigold, even we talked about Sauna, or being able to kind of have a grab and go and a cooler kit ready to bring to your social events. I mean, that's one of the things in my talk too, is just like, you know, bring what you want to drink where you go if you need to, you know, it's, and be the one to host that and introduce other people to it. So there's a lot of ways to come at that. The brick and mortar, you know, across the states that have tried to be solely non-alcoholic have struggled. It's a totally valid concept whose time is, you know, maybe not quite there, but we are starting to see that interest East Coast, West Coast, even Chicago. So there are definitely models of that happening. And would love to have it happen in Minneapolis.
Yeah, and I think what you said about these, like things like Sauna being these healthy options, I think that's another thing. I worked in nutrition for a short period of time. And one of the things that I felt like was so crucial for everybody was to think about what they already, you know, had in their house that they didn't want to have. So sort of starting from scratch there, but then also getting organized about the things that they did want to have. And I feel like that day that we had, you know, together, I've already made like 3 pretty good acquaintances out of that. I was almost not even going to go in because I had forgotten my swimsuit and I had brunch with a friend. And so, mm-hmm. but Reed and I already got together and had a coffee. It's like,
great.
You know, it's amazing the way these things sort of happen. So I think that's another piece of it for anyone who's trying to make a shift. Mm-hmm. is to think about what kinds of things that they already like to do that are healthy options that don't include that, whether it's like maybe if you're looking for a date night for, you know, you and your partner, maybe doing something like a sauna or a hot yoga or a hike, or, you know, looking for, you know, other kinds of events that just don't include that to start out with. Or maybe there will be more options now, you know, of places. And mm-hmm. is that something that you're organizing at all in terms of like where people can find good NA options? Is that part of your mission?
We would love to. I mean, I think with this larger restaurant that we partnered with, we had an event. So we put the NA menu together. Mm. We did all the things behind the scenes, and then we brought people together to experience it. And it was phenomenal. It was like, you know, 75 people in this cozy space that everyone there had a non-alcoholic drink in hand. And you looked around and no one looked like they were somber. I mean, the energy level and the difference of that experience versus being the only one in a space that's drinking non-alcoholic, because that's been my life up to this point, that still felt othering. So to come into a room and an experience where you know everyone is sober and having a great time, it's pretty phenomenal. Yeah. It's like next level. So we want to create more of that. We want to bring that community together, whether it's a bar, restaurant, or event, and highlight what that looks like. And to your point, a lot of it could be, you know, the wellness type activity. So there's also the argument of, well, you know, would people pay for a sauna experience? Well, you look at what you pay to go out to the bar with friends and have dinner, right? And then you just shift that over into your sauna and 2 NA drinks, and you have an equal investment of, you know, fun into your evening, but it looks different.
It looks very different. I mean, I the one thing I felt about that day was that there was kind of an intimacy to the conversations that happened because of the space that we were in mm-hmm. together, and because there wasn't, you know, drinking going on. And I feel like that's another piece that gets missed. I think what alcohol tends to do for us is kind of, you know, overemphasize the ego. I felt like some of the things that people were sharing that day were very different. And I'm used to being in that space. I actually find it very uncomfortable that I can't have these kinds of conversations with people on a regular basis. I guess that's why I started a podcast. But I feel like there is a real opportunity for that to become more of a cultural norm.
Absolutely. Most people don't have those experiences. If you are drinking alcohol, you know, you're connecting with someone on a level where you're just not being vulnerable. You are actually probably not being your true self. And I'm so used to that. So I appreciate this reminder of just being very vulnerable. And like, you're going to get the same me the next day. Like, I'm going to follow up with you and not be like, oh my God, what do we talk about in sauna or right. whatever, you know, it's like, you just have this level of confidence and like you show up consistently, which is a beautiful thing. Yeah. And you just feel like you get to know people on a really deep level really quickly without alcohol.
Yeah. And I felt that with you. And that's part of the reason I felt like mm-hmm. that was a very easy transition into like, let's mm-hmm. have this conversation. I've been wanting mm-hmm. I hadn't met anybody who was so engaged with it at this point in this mm-hmm. way and in this kind of thoughtful manner. So I appreciate you coming to share with you know, all of this with us. And, you know, we'll make sure that people know. Tell me where the easiest place for people to kind of follow you social media wise or website.
Yeah. Thank you for saying all that. I too felt a connection immediately and happy to have this conversation. You can find most of, I would say two things. My personal brand is jengilhoy.com. So it's JenGilHoy.com. And that's my website. And I do have, you know, a sober, not somber Instagram account, which once the TED Talk comes out, a lot of my content around what we're trying to do in the social spaces will be there. And then also zeroproofcollective.com. So we have where you can join the NA movement, which could be on one of two levels as an individual who just wants to know more and get connected into what's happening in the NA scene. And currently it's Twin Cities based, but this is a model that could go all around the country. In fact, we've heard that it really doesn't exist anywhere else. And then you could also, if you are a business that has, you know, is a corporate business that wants to host an event, just interested in the business side, you could select that as well.
Okay. And is that a place where people can find resources as far as, you know, places where things can happen that are NA, you know, related? Are there places you recommend for like the best drinks or any of that kind of stuff?
We are really starting to get there with our community. So Instagram is Zero Proof Collective. Okay. On Instagram is a great place to just find, like, we have people sending us, you know, NA menus, screenshots, and here, get awesome. This here, the experience I had there. We'd like to build that more and really involve the community in doing that, because it really is helpful to hear from so many different experiences and perspectives. And then also not to shame any of these, you know, owners or restaurants, because they just don't know what they don't know. So we want to be here and open to educate and say, here's a possible way you could do more in the NA space.
Yeah. Cool.
And if you have ideas or want to connect, it's hello@zeroproofcollective.com.
Okay, cool. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
All right, Jen, thanks so much. This was fun. We'll have to have a drink soon.
Yes. And you know, it will be NA. That's for
right.
sure.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jen Gilhoy, folks. I love that what Jen offers is the freedom to choose while empowering us to find better options if alcohol is starting to feel restrictive. It's similar to the conversations that I have daily as a healthcare provider to consider the use of a pharmaceutical drug first for quick relief, many times without considering the long-term repercussions and the effects of the drug or an exit strategy or without any other means of support. Jen offers some great thoughts on how we can make shifts personally and in your community in her TED Talk, which I highly recommend, and you can find that here in the show notes. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can reach out to me directly at any time at jeremy@highway2.health. And before you leave or move on to the next episode, I'd really appreciate it if you'd take a minute and rate the show on your app, or if you have an extra minute, write a brief review on why you like the show and anything that's inspired you to improve your health. I greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.